Hello there. My name is Sean. Thank you so much for tuning in today. This is the best of the Seattle kitchen. Tom and Terry are somewhere gallivanting about doing fancy things. I don't know. What do two fancy chefs do on the weekend? I don't know. Probably fancy chef stuff. So anyway, we've got a great show for you today. We've taken some of the best clips from the last year or so, and we're going to, you know, we're going to sit back, relax, have a nice glass of wine, maybe a little bit of steak. I don't know who this we is. I guess it's the royal we. And we're going to listen to some best of the Seattle kitchen. First segment coming at you. We've had author Joel Gamarin. I hope I'm saying that right. And he was on the show recently talking about his new book, Cooking Scrappy.
So, Joel, what's the amazing fad that's going on here? And I don't want to call it a fad, but I think it's more of a learning curve of how to not waste so much of what we spend big bucks for at the grocery store.
Well, okay, so first of all, I'm the head chef for Sur La Table. We've got 83 cooking schools across the country, and I was in one of teaching a class, and I realized I was looking at our trash bowls overfilled with shrimp shells, cucumber seeds that we scooped out for some sauce, potato peels. And I was thinking, you guys know, I mean, Terry and Tom, you know, as chefs, we throw nothing away. We throw absolutely nothing away because that's profit in the restaurant industry. But at home, there's a huge disconnect. No one got taught what we were taught in kitchens or culinary school. And so it felt like a good mission, and it turned into a TV show, which we're in our second season,
good
and my
you.
First cookbook. So we're pretty pumped.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you, what's your background now? I remember talking to you when you were a youngster Palace Kitchen.
Yes. You two have a history.
We got a history. So that day, by the way, Tom, I don't know if I've ever told you this, I was pumping gas in my car. I was so nervous to meet you because you're a legend. So are you, Terry. And you were gracious enough to give me a half hour, and I was going to ask you about the restaurant industry. I spilled gas all over myself.
Really?
I pulled out the nozzle too early.
I thought you just ate beans the night before.
I smelled terrible, but I came in, and you were awesome, and you let me pick your brain. So, you know, I worked in a lot of kitchens in Italy and also in San Francisco. Realized the restaurant wasn't really my thing. I really loved teaching and being around people. And discovered Sur La Table when I was in my early 20s. And now, 10 years later, I'm their national chef. I moved to New York for the past 8 years. Just moved back to Seattle. I've been doing a lot of media and just kind of really trying to inspire people to cook. But the Scrappy mission really started about 4 or 5 years ago when I met Katie Couric on one of her shows in New York. And she got involved as an executive producer, which was really cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought you worked with Martha for a while, too.
No. She would destroy me. Yes. I wouldn't last a day, Tom.
Wouldn't last a day. Okay, so let's jump right into some recipes people might be surprised about.
Yes.
When it comes to cooking Scrappy.
Well, I was excited about seeing you guys get competitive about the wine, so I thought it'd be kind of cool if I threw out a scrap,
okay,
and you guys tell me what you would make with that scrap.
All right.
Let's see if I can stump you.
Oh, I like this game a lot.
Are you in on
Kitty,
it?
No,
you loving this?
I like to view what happens.
Don't let her lie. She is very competitive.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll throw one last one at her on the
end. We'll throw one last one.
We'll see. We'll
judge. You can
help me
judge.
Okay,
so I'll start easy, okay? What would you do with a corn cob without the kernels on it, like a naked corn cob?
Soup.
Easy. Yeah, it's easy. We make stocks with that. We just boil that with water, and then now you have a corn stock, which you can use in a soup.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely delicious.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You can also infuse it in brown butter or butter and make a really beautiful corn butter, which is really nice.
Oh,
toss that on lobster or crab or something like that, which would be really sweet.
And then is there any way to eat that cob? Have you figured that out?
No, but a lot of people use it as kindling.
Kindling.
Is that weird? They throw it in the fire. It actually burns pretty good.
Huh.
Okay, you ready for the next one? All right, next one is, what would you do, let's just think about it, with the pea pod shells? So after you shell the peas, what would you do with those shells?
I would boil them, and I would make a wonderful puree out of that. I would put in my Vitamix. No advertising. I don't own the company.
It almost seems like you do with all the name drops.
But you need a fast blender. You need something that's, you know, pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Blend the heck out of it, and then strain it, and then you have this wonderful pea puree. And it's actually a pretty intense flavor.
Yeah.
The pod is much more intense than the actual pea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have to make sure you use that correctly. But you take that and you could use it as a sauce for fish, or you could use it as a soup.
I love that.
What would you do with those pods?
So I did a really gorgeous salad, but you can char them on the outside. I mean, obviously, they're super edible, but if you just blacken them in like a cast iron skillet with some really hot olive oil, they get that really sweet flavor. And so I toss them with some soba noodles, some sesame seeds and some radishes, and they're beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Have you tried that with fava bean pods also?
I don't think those are edible. Are they edible?
Yeah, they're edible. For
no
sure.
way. Are you serious?
Yeah.
They better be young and tender.
Yes, just young ones.
Yeah.
Just blanch them and throw them straight on the charcoal grill.
I had no idea. Because they're such a pain in the butt to shell favas, and so you feel like it's such a loss for all those. Have you ever had the fava leaves?
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Those are
salad.
Insane.
Those are good.
They're a little furry.
Insane. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're delicious.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're going to go to a really hard one. You ready? What would you do with a peach pit?
I would put it in a bottle of vodka and wait for December and have a wonderful peach vodka. This is all delicious.
Yes, yes.
Pits are really good to make infused alcohol. They're very delicious because you don't get that. I mean, obviously, nobody wants to take a pit and try cracking it.
Yeah.
But if you gently crack it and put it in vodka, man, it's like by December, you've got this wonderful nectar.
That's awesome. Mm.
Yeah.
Tom?
I'd put it in the mortar and pestle. And make a little facial scrub with it. A defoliator.
So
I was wondering, Tom.
Defoliator. Come on.
Tom, I was wondering why your face looked like that.
Yeah, exactly. That's where this redness comes from.
You need to take the shell out.
Some people thought it was gin. It turns out to be peach pits.
I love it. That's awesome. So what we do is we do it, Terry, exactly. You can make the simple syrup like you were talking about in the earlier segment. 1-to-1 sugar to water, boil the peach pits, and it gives this really almondy kind of toasty flavor. And I think this is like the story of the book is these are ingredients we all have, right? Yeah. We have corn cobs, we've got pea shells, we've got peach pits, and you know these are just flavors that maybe people haven't tried before. So it's not asking you to go find a crazy ingredient or go somewhere outside the house. It's saying just look at the ingredient a little bit differently. Look at it whole.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of reminds me a bit of how we used to think about certain cuts of meat being the prime cuts of the meat.
Right.
And that everyone else who had maybe less money or had to do with what was left over would use kind of the nastier bits of food. But in fact, it's a bit of a misconception, and the same goes with all of these vegetables that we're bringing to the fore, right? You can use everything. Everything is perfectly delicious. We've just kind of been conditioned to think that some bits of the plant are better than other bits.
I mean, I totally agree with you, Katie. Do you guys remember when hanger steak was, like, not a good cut?
Well, it was always the chef's cut is what it was always called.
But that was, like, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And now it's, like, $25 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an example of a scrap or something that, you know, I'm sure at some point celery root was, you know, a scrap. No one wanted it. They wanted the celery. And then
It's still a pretty obscure vegetable to most.
Exactly. But at least it's at grocery stores, you know. And so, I don't know, when kale stems start to become cool and, you know, all these different parts of the vegetables that are not cool, that's when I think the mission is over, but we're not there yet.
That's right, Joel. We're not there yet at all. My name is Sean. Thanks for tuning in to the best of the Seattle Kitchen here on Cairo Radio. Coming up next segment, should you or should you not salt your pasta water? We'll find out when we return here with the best of the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're here in the Hot Stove Society, a cooking school where we learn all sorts of things. Today, we're going to tackle a problem that I created last week.
Yes, this is your own doing, this problem.
I have no problem with this. I stand by my creation.
Okay, good.
So the question came up from our listener last week. She went onto our Facebook page and asked the question about cooking, which people often do. And the question was, I don't know how much to salt the water before I cook my pasta, because everybody says something different. Some people say don't even salt the water. Some people say put a fistful of salt.
Yeah, like the sea should be really salty.
Yeah, saline is the sea. So I, in my wisdom, said to myself, well...
Bridget's already laughing.
I said to myself,
I love when you
said, you know, we are always preaching about not using salted butter, but so use unsalted butter so that you can control the salt in your dish.
Right.
Right? That's something that's very common. I would bet even Chef Bridget Charters, who's an instructor here at Hot Stove, would agree with that. And so...
100%.
So it doesn't make sense to me then... in answering her question about pasta water, to salt your pasta water at a certain level, which you're not even really sure what it is. You're just putting in a little thing of salt. and then not be able to control the salt. Maybe it was too... Maybe you overcooked your pasta and it soaked up too much salt water. It becomes too salty. Whereas, to me, if you have it all here, you can season it as you taste it.
Mm-hmm, okay? Mm-hmm.
And I also do have a bent that chefs use too much salt, which is why sometimes when you eat in a fancy restaurant, you go home at night, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're gasping for a glass of
you
water.
You can't take your rings off.
Oh, it's not,
it's not,
off.
It's not because of the two bottles of wine you drank during dinner?
No, it's because of the, salt in your dinner. Anyway.
Should we let Bridget talk a little bit?
So, Bridget, I'm going to invite Bridget in to chat. And, Katie, you can take over from here. Because will you turn that fire off, please? My God, what are you doing?
Bridget's Chef. Cooking, Tom's directing, and trying to do a show. It's
Tom,
a lot.
She's the one trying to prove something, so you let her cook.
So... Bridget, explain your position, if you would.
So, Tom, I became very inflamed and irritated at seeing that post on Facebook by the Seattle Kitchen.
You and 100 other people.
Holy smokers. So, the deal with salting the water is the Italians say, salt the water, not the sauce.
Why?
Because if you salt, so you salt the water to taste. You never, nobody measures the amount of water that they're using to make their pasta. So it's best that they get the water in the pot, bring it to a boil, and then add the salt. Don't add the salt to the cold water in that cold pot because it will pit your stainless steel.
Okay.
Or any other metal. So it's important. Now, the Italians have pots of coarse salt. You know, I know the Europeans in general use coarse salt.
Gray salt.
Gray salt or a coarse style rock salt. Mm-hmm. We call it rock salt here in America. And the reason for that, and I did a little research, Paul Bertoli says that coarse salt is 83% sodium chloride. It has potassium, iodine, and minerals. So sea salts vary as to where you harvest them. The Italians talk about it. Marcella mentions it in her book, Trapanese salt versus the salt off of the Adriatic. And the flavor.
But here's my question. You mentioned that the Italians are saying salt your water, not your sauce. Why would you not salt a sauce?
You do. In the cooking process, salt aids at the beginning, middle, and end. You salt at the beginning. Those items, those onions you're sweating, mm-hmm. that salt helps to release the moisture in the vegetables, the onions in particular. So a little bit. Don't go nuts. Then as it's cooking, you taste it. And then once that sauce cools down, your tomato sauce, your ragu, what have you, once that sauce cools down and then you reheat it, it might need something, but we always wait. The Italian, I don't have a speck of Italian in me, but I've lived there. So the Italians
you
use...
You think you were.
The Italians, yes, I wish. The Italians use Parmigiano Reggiano or Grana Padano.
Yeah.
And so the cheese goes in.
Right.
If they've salted the water, that cheese is your final kind of application. And the pasta water, the reason Italian pastas taste so good in Italy is because they use that starchy pasta water that contains the starch molecules from the water.
To finish the cooking in the sauce. To create
emulsify
more,
yes.
So the salt gets added a second time through the pasta water itself in the final stages of the cooking process. I am curious to taste these two side by side in terms of one with salted water and then one that's just salted after the pasta's been cooked and you're adding the residual salt.
And Katie, I would love it if you would taste. So we used a really high-quality pasta. It's Rusticella d'Abruzzo. It's in the brown paper bags at the grocery store. Rolando, the owner of that company, was here, and he travels Italy. He's an Italian, and he's always talking about pasta. I'd love it if you would taste the pasta water. And then I have some samples of the cooked pasta, water, salt versus no salt. No salt versus salt. And then the sauces. Okay.
So what I tasted now is I tasted the sauce. Now, the sauce itself might have been salted before. I don't know.
Lightly.
So
and you can
your argument about not salting the sauce is totally blown at this point because you just said you salted the sauce.
You didn't listen, Tom.
Oh, okay.
Too busy eating pasta over there.
What if Warren she just said it was lightly salted?
Well, it's we salt. It's your recipe, man. We follow your
recipe. I definitely salt my sauce. I definitely do. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And salt, when you're making sauces, that salt helps in the preservation process. So if you salt your sauce when you're making it or your ragu, salt is a preservative. So salt's going to protect the shelf life of those items you're making.
Mm-hmm. So we tasted the one where we did the plain pasta cooked in plain water in the tomato sauce and then added the salt over top. And then we did the one where the pasta water was salted and didn't add any extra salt to the pasta dish when it was done. To me, if I'm being perfectly honest, there's not a ton of difference other than I find the other one too salty. I find the salted water one too salty in a beginning place.
It's a little bit high on salt.
And I think it's because of the pasta water that you use to thicken the sauce.
I think maybe it was a little bit heavy on salt. It's a bit heavy on salt.
And that's before we get cheese.
The other one.
That's before we get cheese or mussels or clams or anything like that in there. So,
Tom, are you on a special diet that you're not telling us about?
Well,
the doctor recommend that you cut the vodka and
no,
the salt?
I'm on a diet where I try to buy foods that actually have flavor instead of trying to salt them to flavor.
Oh, whatever.
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 So Jamie, who was just on the previous segment, told me an interesting thing in that the Asians use... they do not salt their water, and they use very special waters to cook their different noodles because they use an alkaline-based spring water to flavor the noodle, and the weed is very important, and they want to taste all of that. So
yes.
I kind of understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
But I think it's a
concession.
I will tell you, I didn't taste any real difference.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of debunking... You don't need to salt your water. You can if you want.
From this
it doesn't
particular
really matter.
Test, I don't think you need to.
Yeah.
So for all of you who emailed me on Facebook, you can apologize right now.
Oh, here goes another 100 emails.
We have fun doing this. This is what the hot stove is all about, is thinking about thinking these things through, right?
I personally think, and I'm from the country that seasons the water, obviously that salts the water, I think that it was a little bit over-salted, and I like the one that's a little bit less salted because I can add my own salt. Then that was the only thing that I
all
can
right.
say about this.
Here's the end of that.
That is the end of that, Tom. And it's also the end of this segment for the Best of the Seattle Kitchen. Hey, my name is Sean. Actually, I don't even know if I've told you who the hell I am. I am behind the scenes here at Cairo Radio working on the Dory Monson Show and the new afternoon show. And I'm behind the scenes at the Seattle Kitchen Show. We record every Tuesday morning. So coming up next on the Best of the Seattle Kitchen, we're talking bread. So if you've got a gluten intolerance, you should probably turn the radio off, like right now. You're listening to the Best of Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Here we go. It's here back in the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society. We're thrilled to bring back Nathan Myhrvold. He is the famous for the Modernist Cuisine book series.
And the Modernist Bread.
And the brand new Modernist Bread. It's not so brand new anymore, is it?
It's a year old.
A year old, yeah. It's very nice. And also your fabulous gallery, which Terry and I got to tour maybe 3 months ago down on First Avenue.
Yep.
Right by the Art Museum. So, what's going on? I can see that you are not cutting carbs.
Well, yeah, I'm wearing a T-shirt.
No, you have to see his shirt. They're thinking I'm giving you a hard time.
Tom's not just being mean. And for our radio listeners, Nathan is wearing a black tee, and it's got a nice pizza cutter on there, and it says, "This is how I cut carbs."
That's right.
We'll take a picture of it and post it on our Facebook page.
So, right now I'm writing a book on pizza.
Really?
Yep.
Awesome.
And I've eaten a lot of pizza.
So is there really a lot of good pizza out there, or is there a lot of bad pizza out there?
Well, like everything in life, there's more mediocre than there is great. But there's a lot of great pizza.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've had so much in the world.
And pizza is interesting because wherever it goes in the world, people adopt it, make it their own, and then they get really angry at the other ones. They say, well, that's not pizza. Mm-hmm. My thing I grew up with, that's what pizza is. And, you know, the Italians have a little, or the people in Naples anyway, have a little bit more reason to do that than others. But everybody does it.
Yeah. Chicago, New York, that's the number one fight in this country.
We keep finding more styles of pizza. There's something called Cuban pizza, which you might think is found in Cuba, but it isn't. It's only found in Miami. Yeah. there's a bunch of cities in the Midwest that have their own new style of pizza.
New style.
Yeah.
So what makes it new style? What's on it?
In that case, I've not been there to eat it yet, so I can't say for sure, but their sauce is a little spicy, and there's like three or four other things, most of which I think is kind of stretching it to call it a separate style. But
is that a little pun on pizza? Stretching it?
There you go.
Yeah. Let's just get one more pizza question out of the way. What style of pizza is the worst?
Like, oh, man.
Controversial.
Let's just get one ugly question out of the way. Because I've always thought Chicago-style pizza was the worst, but now we have a pretty good Chicago-style pizza here that I kind of like. It's a very different kind of thing than I grew up with. We have is it called Windy City?
Windy
pizza?
City.
Yeah, it's been on the show. Did you just go and you says, I don't ever want to eat this thing they call pizza again?
Well,
other than Sirius Pie.
New Haven, Connecticut.
Really?
Oh.
Everyone says loves it, and I, and the people who grew up on it, like, genuinely love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a true thing for everything. I mean, people who grew up on Twinkie love Twinkie.
Tom and I have this argument about the In-N-Out burger all the time.
Yeah.
He hates it, and I feel like that is a very cultural thing that if you grew up in Southern California and it was a warm day, you have an affinity.
You wanted a poached burger with bad fries.
Oh, you stop it. You stop it right now.
Okay, let's go back to Brad. New Haven, though, that's pretty interesting. You're going to... Pepe's people are going to be angry at you. All right, modernist bread.
No, it turns out they're angry at you when you're there too.
Just generally angry.
No, it's one of the things that not all of them, not Pepe's, but several of the pizzerias there are famous for having rude, gruff service and them yelling at you.
Yeah.
And that's like a feature.
Yeah, that's not my idea of fun. I know people kind of like that, mm-hmm. like the bad diner service.
Yeah, like the Wiener Circle.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Okay.
Anyway, modernist bread. Let's go back to that. The way we think about bread from the ground up. So that's kind of a theme in all of your books, is to take it all the way back to the beginning and think about how it got to where it is, how it happens, the science behind it, and then through photography, showing us the process.
And bread was challenging because, first of all, there's so many kinds of bread.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to flatbreads, oh, my God, are there a lot of flatbreads on planet Earth. We made a cutoff that to be in the bread book, it had to be microbially leavened. So that meant sourdough or yeast breads, but not soda breads, except Irish soda bread, which is trying to be a wannabe yeast bread, mm-hmm. shaped like one, mm-hmm. looks like one. The other thing that's challenging photographically about bread is it's all shades of brown.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you don't get big, beautiful reds and greens and colors like you get with fruits and vegetables.
Unless you let it sit in a plastic bag too long. Then there's a lot of color that happens.
We did that experiment, in fact, to reprise Alexander Fleming's discovery of penicillin.
Really? That's interesting.
Penicillin is a bread mold. And it creates this antibiotic, not to try to make us better. It does it to poison the surroundings so no other microbes can steal its food.
Hmm. Oh, wow. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it's a common... that's also how sourdough works.
Right.
So lactobacillus is a bacteria that pisses out a poison called lactic acid. That's what makes yogurt.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeast pisses out a poison called alcohol. Famously, wonderfully, it pisses that poison out.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that yeast can tolerate a bit of acid, and the lactobacillus can tolerate a bit of alcohol. either one of them by itself can get invaded by other microorganisms. But if they co-invade between the two of them, mm-hmm. nothing else can. And that's why a sourdough culture is stable.
Interesting. Oh, wow. And that's why they could take it on the road for so long. And
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, otherwise a sourdough culture would be like anything that would go bad in your fridge. It would eventually get infected with some mold or some other organism that would eat it up and make it bad.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Very interesting.
Where else you want to get out of this book? What's some good tips about bread baking and not screwing it up, if you know what I mean? Because often, you know, burning up the yeast or...
The first thing to do is not to worry about screwing things up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say, I think that's what most people's fear is when it comes to bread. There's something, even though it's like the roots of so many people's culture, when we bring it into our home kitchens, it becomes a very fearful task in a lot of ways.
But there is almost nothing at the grocery store cheaper than flour.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, true.
Has that always been the case?
Yeah, well...
You know, like salt and sugar used to be super expensive, right? But now it's inexpensive.
So, you know, throughout all of history, our main concern was starvation.
Mm-hmm.
And bread is one of the funny commodities in the world where there have regularly been riots about it. And in the book, we've got a picture of riots before the British Parliament in the 1700s about the price of bread, and riots in Egypt... in 2014,
yeah.
About the price of bread.
Very recently.
So bread has this very special relationship with us. As a result, we tried to make bread cheap. And we tried to make flour cheap. And through lots of innovations, we succeeded, unfortunately. I say unfortunately because we have $2 loaves of bread, but they don't taste very good. And these days, our problem...
And they're actually not good for you either.
Well, there's nothing to recommend them at all. But we've gone through such a long period of time obsessing about making bread cheap, it's hard to turn the ship around.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and if you look at chocolate, when I was a kid, chocolate only used to be Hershey's.
Right.
Or coffee was Folgers. You know, that's what Mom bought.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have this huge explosion of producers, and... You can't get quality unless every part of the chain, from the farmer to the consumer, has quality.
Correct.
Which is why you want to make sure you get good beans for coffee or chocolate and roast them well and this whole process. Well, bread is such a commoditized thing that it's probably the most... backward with respect to this process of any food. Our ideas about the price of bread are very funny. You know, if you try to charge for bread in a restaurant, people get mad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone was expressing...
It's funny. They will pay $7 for a bottle of water, but they want bread for free.
And I was talking to someone about this, and I said, well, okay, do you think risotto should be free? So there'd be like some principle that risotto should always be.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd really like that.
And the guy says, well, no, you know, risotto is
easy. I got some on my menu.
it's this creative part that the chef does. Of course we pay for risotto. Well, duh. If you want great bread,
mm-hmm.
you got to be willing to pay a little more for it, either in money or in convenience.
We've been talking with Nathan Myhrvold of The Cooking Lab, co-author of Modernist Cuisine and his book out called Bread, Modernist Cuisine Bread, on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And we have a special guest, Andy Richter, is here. Or I just called him Andy Richter. It's Ricker.
Ricker.
Andy Ricker is here. He's got a new book, Pock Pock Noodles. And if you live in Seattle and you go to Portland every once in a while, my guess is you've been to Pock Pock down there in the southeast, I believe. Is that right, Andy?
Correct. And it's funny, like the Andy Richter thing that happens all the time. We get mistaken for each other constantly on Twitter. Much to my chagrin and his amusement.
So, you know, your restaurant is infamous. You've gone on to great things in your career. It's exciting to have you on the show. Your book is astonishingly beautiful, I think. The photography is great and alive. And I think that's the hardest thing to do in cookbooks sometimes is to make the food come alive. Everyone wants to style food to death, but I feel like your book brings the food alive. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. We have a very good team. We've done all three books together. It's myself, J.J. Good is my co-writer, and then Austin Bush is the photographer. And then also there's a fourth member of the team that doesn't get mentioned much, and he's the guy who does the work on the photos after they've been taken, the post-production part. And, you know, the great thing is that Austin is a 20-year resident of Thailand, and so not only is he a good photographer, but he really understands the material. So you're not trying to explain to somebody why there shouldn't be chopsticks or lime on the plate or whatever. He knows the food, and he instinctually gets the right shot that shows it off the best.
Yeah, and those are my favorite shots, too, are the live ones from around the world or from Thailand itself. They're just... I'm jealous. I've never been to Thailand. It's on my bucket list. I can't wait to go. But in the meantime, I'm going to buy your book called Pak Pak Noodles and kind of cook my way through it. It looks delicious.
Excellent.
Where does one start? If I buy your book, where do I start, Andy?
You mean like what thing should you try to cook first?
Correct.
Okay, so on the cover of the book, there's a bowl of noodles, and that's called Kwetiau Nam Kai, which means chicken noodle soup. And the reason I chose that to be the cover of the book was, first, it's a nice shot with nice colors and stuff. But second of all, it's kind of the most simple expression of a Thai soup noodle. It's also very, very satisfying, and it's very easy to make. So I feel like that is kind of what the best way to get into this book is to start with that recipe. It's very simple. You just have to make a nice chicken stock. You have to start with some good chicken. And then it's very simply seasoned, and you choose your noodles to go with it. And it's easy to pull off. Everybody will like it. And it's simple.
That's usually what makes a great dish, to be simple and delicious. You know, it's like, that's usually what it works in every culture, I think.
Not to get too esoteric here, Andy, but you just said you have to start with a nice chicken. I was in a... I'll call it a Chinatown market over the weekend, having a little dim sum south of Seattle. And this market, I went by the frozen chicken area, and there's these chickens kind of head first in a bag. They actually had been plucked, but they look like somebody went over to the coop, wrang a neck, and popped it into a bag. And, you know, the feet are hanging out the top of the bag upside down in the freezer case. And they're just like, I was trying to think, who would buy this chicken?
Me.
And then what would you do? Seems perfect for that.
That's exactly the chicken that you want.
Exactly.
So in Thailand, we call that gai ban, which means village chicken. Right. Here they call them, I think, Buddhist walking chicken. Essentially, they're a breed of chicken that's thick-skinned. There's not much fat on them. They're very, very flavorful. And they're just kind of the perfect. You probably don't want to try to make fried chicken out of it. It'd be like eating rubber bands. But mm-hmm. they're made for stewing. They're quite expensive too, because they raise them, you know, naturally and kill them. It's not a big factory concern. So those are great chicken. If you live in a big city that has halal or Chinese poultry market where you can get freshly killed birds, that's even better.
Right.
You just go and ask them for a Buddhist walking chicken or a stewing chicken.
Boy, I haven't seen that around lately, you know, down in Chinatown in L.A. or places like that where you used to be able to go in San Francisco and just cages of live birds and order your bird and they take it back and handle it for you. And next thing you know, you've got a nice chicken walking out of the store. Do they still have those kind of markets in this country?
Sure. I'm in Chinatown, L.A. right now, and within a 1-minute walk from the front of the plaza I'm in, there are two poultry markets that will do that. I also live in Brooklyn, Chinatown, and there's several live poultry markets there as well as Manhattan. And anywhere where there's a large Chinese population, there's usually one of these markets. I guess depending on what the sort of the regulations for the city are as far as health and all that kind of stuff. But the smell's a little bit intense. The first time you go, it might be a little off-putting, but it is the best way to get the freshest poultry available.
All right, let's move on from chicken soup. Maybe a couple other top favorite recipes in your new book called Noodles, Puck Puck Noodles.
Sure. So moving from the soup noodles to a kind of a fried noodle, I would suggest maybe doing the, let's see. Well, there's a few different ones that make sense for the home cook, but I think the sukiyaki or dry sukiyaki noodle is a really great dish to cook at home. And another thing about it is that it really appeals to Westerners, I think, because it has a lot of vegetables in it. And that typically, that's a little unusual for most Thai noodles, is to have tons of vegetables in it. This one has a kind of a melange of vegetables, some glass noodles, egg, protein, pork, usually pork or shrimp, and then a really deeply umami-rich sauce that involves fermented tofu and a few other things. And I really recommend that one. It's quite easy to make on a stovetop, just using a nonstick wok pan. So that would be a good one to try, I think.
Yum.
To do a different category would be bami hang, which is a wheat noodle done dry style, meaning there's no soup in the noodle itself, but it's also not fried. You basically it's more like a salad almost. You boil the noodles and you prepare the proteins and the various different things to flavor it, and you just throw it into a bowl and mix it up. And you serve a little bowl of consomme or broth on the side. But really, it's a really common way of eating noodles in Thailand, dry style, that you don't see here as often.
Sounds so delicious. The new book is called Pok Pok Noodles. Andy Ricker is the author with J.J. Good. Pok Pok is a restaurant down in Portland. Also, you've opened a couple other locations around the country.
I did, but I closed them.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I had some in New York and some in L.A., but I'm done with those. I pulled up roots in both of those cities, even though I'm in L.A. right now on book tour. And now it's just Portland. We've got six restaurants in Portland, and we've got one licensing deal at the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas for our Pok Pok wing counter service model. And that's what we got now.
All right.
Good for you.
If you don't get to go to Portland, this book is the next best thing. I would suggest you find it anywhere online or at a bookstore. 10 Speed Press is the publisher. And we will talk to Andy again soon. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Hello there. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen, the best of the Seattle Kitchen here on Cairo Radio. My name is Sean. I appreciate you tuning in today. So Tom and Terry are doing something fancy, and they're not here. So I just decided to gather up some of the best clips from the show from the past year and put them in a certain order and then talk to you about how I'm going to play them for you. See, that's just getting way too technical on the radio. So coming up this segment, Tom and Terry had, who they have in? They had Mary J. White in, and she's got a new book called Everyday Mary J., A Practical Guide to Cooking with Cannabis. So if you like getting high, this segment is for you.
You've got a new book called A Practical Guide to Cooking with Cannabis.
Yeah, the actual title is Everyday Mary J., because that's how often I think you ought to use the medicine.
Uh-huh.
But it's a practical guide because I've been teaching cooking with cannabis for about 8 years. And so this isn't one of those chefy books, you know. It's more about practical ways to use. Mm-hmm. I'm calling it medicine because that's what it is.
Are people finally getting... Oops, sorry, Terry.
It's okay.
Are people finally getting over the drama that they think that you're going to get high if you use marijuana products?
Yeah, because we know so much more now mm-hmm. about cannabis, and all the propaganda is kind of going away.
Well, we should start by saying THC versus CBD people understand the difference.
We're getting there, buddy. Yeah. We're getting there. Yeah. Because we're talking about three different kinds, three main types of cannabis.
Right.
So your CBD, which people are hugely into right now, is primarily one of the big cannabinoids that you find in the plant. Mm-hmm. So hemp, ruderalis is almost pure CBD. There's no THC. So that is a wonderful thing to use for, you know, anxiety and stress and seizures and all that kind of stuff, right? But the THC that people are so concerned about is really important. Because with cannabis, you have over 100 cannabinoids, and they all do something different to the body. And we're talking about an entourage effect. So I think what I'm trying to tell you guys is don't be scared of THC, because there's all these things in cannabis that work together. And people are starting to understand that you're not going to go crazy and jump off a building. It cannot physically hurt you, unlike an opioid.
Right.
Right? Because it doesn't affect the brainstem.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm more concerned. There's a lot of recipes in the book, obviously, but I mostly want to teach you guys why. Why would you want to use cannabis?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Yeah,
so I think that's the most important part in the in the whole story. I mean, there's been plenty and plenty of research about showing actually the benefits of CBD and THC as well. So,
let's have dinner.
Okay.
Let's have dinner with cannabis.
All right.
Or
cannabis.
Let's talk about the recipes in your book to make a dinner.
Okay.
Okay.
What I recommend when using cannabis is I don't normally have a dinner party with cannabis and everything.
Oh, you can't.
Well, you can't, because people are going to be in your damn sofa on Tuesday, you know? And that's not so good.
It is.
You know?
It's the guests that never left.
Yeah, exactly. They're all melted and stuff. But I like to do more like appetizers that are medicated if people are down with that, right? So there are recipes like majoun, which is a Moroccan compound. There's, there's these cheddar stuffed olives.
Mm.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
You know, there's dip, there's stuff like that. And what I like to do is have a little at the beginning, and then everybody's sort of happy by the entree, and then they get the hell out by dessert, you know?
Well, they're starving by the entree. So so let's talk about the cheddar stuffed olive recipe.
Well, it's that cocktail vibe from the 50s. So you basically take a green olive and you cover it like in a cheese pastry, but in the cheese pastry is cannabis. Yeah.
I think the big question, and I think a lot of people have this question too, if you've ever cooked with cannabis at home, some people are familiar with extracting the medicinal properties through kind of low heat in butter more often than not.
Yes.
Is that really the way to do it? Is there a better way to do it? Are there different ways to do it?
That is a very good question, and I would say there's different ways to do it. What you're looking at is a medicinal plant with all this good stuff on it, right? And how do you get that stuff out of there?
Right.
So you can use heat and fat, or you can use cold and alcohol, which is how you make tinctures.
You can also use sugar and salt. I mean, there's like Ruby makes an infused sugar and an infused salt as well.
It's so easy.
Yeah, it's very simple and very easy to use.
Well, I mean, tell us how you do it.
You can just drop this in your coffee and drink your coffee and be done with that.
Yep. And what you do is the tincture that I'm talking about, the alcohol tincture, you put it on sugar and then dehydrate it back to sugar real slowly. And then you have beautiful sugar that's filled with cannabis.
Or you can just buy the package already made so you don't spend three hours doing that.
Yeah, you can. But that's the other thing, though, Terry, about making it yourself, is that once you get a little cannabis on board, you can make a ton of stuff.
You can dry paste fruit. You can do all kinds of different things.
You need to come over to my house.
Oh, yeah?
We'll play around. It'll be fun.
I'm all about the cooking part of it.
Yeah, me too. Well, and that's the thing. You know, people tend to think, oh, we're just going to be all high and wear dreadlocks and tie-dye. No. Mm-hmm. You can micro-dose, and that's what most people do. Because you got to function. You know, you don't want to be drooling and eating Cheetos.
So, Mary, how do you control that? So, if you go to one of the larger stores, most edible products are probably going to be in a 5 milligram or 10 milligram dose.
Yeah.
And if you're new to ingesting, you know, cannabinoid products, edibles, you might be concerned that 5 might be too much or 10 might be too much. And so, how do you determine the dosing when you're cooking at home?
There are many, many variables.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about starting at a dispensary is you can know, 5 milligrams, gives me a little bit of a hangover. You know, cannabis is all about tolerance, and of course, the more you use, the more you use, because you just get better and better. But okay, if you're making it at home, first of all, you need to know how much THC basically is in the cannabis that you have. Mm-hmm. Now, if you get it at a dispensary, you know, half a gram for, or half an ounce, 14 grams, it'll say X amount of percent. And then it gets real mathy and complicated, but it's not insurmountable. Mm-hmm. Like if your cannabis has 100 milligrams, for example, and you're making 24 mini cupcakes, do the division.
Yeah.
You know, but the issue is when you grow your own, you have to kind of experiment.
Yeah.
Which can be fun.
I was going to say, could be a good time.
It can also be, you know, night-night.
Well, I hope y'all learned a lot about cooking in pot. You think I'm going to go into a, like a rhyme here? I don't got no time here to go into a rhyme here. Nice, Sean. This is Sean. This is the best of the Seattle Kitchen. Tom and Terry will be back next week. Coming up next on the best of the Seattle Kitchen, the guys are going to talk to Judith Dern. And what are they going to talk to her about? I know. So you're going to have to stay tuned to find out. But it has to do with food and Seattle. Go figure. You're listening to the best of Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the best of the Seattle Kitchen. My name is Sean. Thanks for tuning in today. Tom and Terry will be back next week. They'll be live. Well, sort of live. I'll let you figure out what that means. Because I certainly don't. The guys here talked to a woman named Judith Dern a few months ago. Learned a lot about Seattle and sort of the history of the food within it. It's coming up for you right now. The best of the Seattle Kitchen.
It's so fun. You know, being 60 years old now, not only am I looking for cemeteries, but I am one of the few left that remembers the Seattle food scene from 50 years ago or 40 years ago. I guess I got here 41 years ago. So it's fun to see some of the references in here to some of the restaurants when I first got here, like the Golden Lion at the Olympic Hotel. That was one of the places where I used to go see jazz and eat prime rib. It was super fun. And there's a lot of places like that that aren't remembered around this town anymore. Certainly Victor Rossellini's places and fun things like that. So I want to say you wanted to focus a little bit today on how immigrants have changed the Seattle food scene.
Immigrants have been here from the beginning.
Yeah.
They came for the jobs in the lumber industry, in the maritime industry, canneries, fishing, you name it.
Railroad.
Absolutely. Railroads were instrumental in getting people here.
Mm-hmm.
The first railroad ended in Tacoma, so it took them 10 years to build the extension to Seattle.
Is that right?
But it happened in 1893.
It seems like the problem seems to be reoccurring.
Sounds very familiar. I think we just approved funds for that.
you could say that, yes, yeah. Yes. But people came here for jobs. There was the 1862 Homestead Act gave people land. Mm-hmm. They could get 160 acres, and that drew a lot of immigrants from Europe. And then other people came as the economy suffered in their home countries. Mm-hmm. They came to work. And it was interesting to go back through the history and see that when the Chinese came, there were different laws that all of a sudden it's like, no, you can't come anymore.
Uh-huh.
And then before World War II, there was another law that said people from Eastern Europe couldn't come. But certainly the groups that have come have been instrumental in building our culinary history, both past and present.
Interesting.
Yeah, it seems like it's always how it starts. Somebody comes from somewhere else and go, have you guys tried this before? You know, you're showcasing what you have at home, what you're missing. You know, often Tom refers to soldiers coming back from wars and, you know, kind of like going, well, I was in Vietnam, I had some banh mi, I want to eat some banh mi. You know, it's like suddenly banh mi becomes something.
Food is definitely a cultural connection.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
And then in 1896, there was a shipping line established between Seattle and Asia, which meant that all of a sudden they could bring in the authentic foods ingredients, and that really boosted the Chinese and Japanese grocery stores, restaurants. They were mostly in Pioneer Square.
Mm-hmm.
And moved out from that area. But the Japanese, the Italians were also important as truck farmers. And that supplied both markets in the city and Pike Place Market when it started.
They kind of started that, right? The truck farmers did.
Yes.
They were upset at the middlemen that were gouging.
Exactly.
Gouging people.
Yes.
Yeah.
1907 is a landmark.
Oh, interesting. Native cuisine doesn't seem to have survived a whole lot, and nor was it probably very hard to accomplish, right? You know, dried salmon or preserved berries or something like that. Is there any sort of native cuisine left?
Not that much.
Mm-hmm.
They are also, the native people are trying to revive it among their own people,
mm-hmm.
which has been interesting to see. Food is, again, the connection.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was interesting is a lot of the Asian cultures that came here included ingredients that were local. I mean, they would start using Dungeness crab. They would start using salmon.
Uh-huh.
So there was an interpretation using local ingredients.
Well, it's a lot more efficient and a lot fresher to use local ingredients than using anything brought into town.
Yes.
Are you saying then that when the white settlers came from the east, that they weren't using those ingredients, that it wasn't a natural connection to their own foods?
Not initially.
Not initially.
They wanted bread, so they, until the wheat fields got established in eastern Washington, a lot of the flour was brought in by ship,
mm-hmm.
and things that were familiar came by ship, and that gradually changed as eastern Washington was cultivated.
Interesting.
And the railroads again brought it over the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get a little bit more recent in like the 60s and 70s in the Seattle restaurant scene. I got here in 77, and there was a prolific kind of a classic American restaurant scene, whether it was Ivers or Rosalini's, you know, typical kind of red sauce American-Italian food that you might have found in South Philadelphia or that nature. There was the King Oscar's and places like that that had steak with crab on top and sauce. What did you find when you did your research about kind of mid-century food in this, or mid-last century, I guess it is now? But
I thought it was interesting that the Greeks managed and owned about 75% of the restaurants in Seattle in the 1960s.
Uh-huh.
They weren't necessarily serving Greek food that we think of authentic. But they had adapted menus to what was American.
Right.
So that was pretty much the standard.
Yeah, there used to be one at 5th and right across from Dahlia over there. There used to be, block from Dahlia. There used to be a diner there.
Steve Spoiler.
Yeah, Steve Spoiler.
He was a Greek and was very well known. He had a 24-hour restaurant right there across the street.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They didn't survive the 60s. I think what did happen was there was a whole teriyaki phase. Seattle became well known for that in the 70s. And one restaurant spawned several others as people set up their own franchises.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing about restaurants, you know, and that's why you see so many of them. And that's why they come and go so quickly, because the cost of entry is fairly inexpensive. When you look at, you know, you could open a business tomorrow for $100,000, a teriyaki joint, for $100,000, you know. To sustain that with your rent and your labor after that is where it becomes more difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I know in 2015, the Huffington Post did a survey, and it found that the restaurants in Seattle that were most popular were Japanese, Vietnamese, Korean, and Chinese,
mm-hmm.
and that was very different than the rest of the country.
Is it really?
Yes.
I didn't realize that. That it just seems like everywhere you go, it's filled with Asian food of some sort or another.
And it's become more authentic. I mean, we have mm-hmm. Vietnamese. You can find Vietnamese pho and teriyaki side by side.
Yeah. Right.
When I took Martin Yan through, of Yan Ken Cook, I took him through our Chinatown a few years back, he just was marveling at what an old Chinatown that we had. It has even changed since we did that maybe five or 8 years ago. But he just said, this is a historic old Chinatown compared to the new Chinatown down in L.A. or someplace where there's more modern immigration, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, you can still go there and find the real thing.
You can. And if you go to the Wing Luke Museum, you can really find it. They even institutionalized a grocery store, Huayang Grocery, that I used to shop at myself. So super fun. Well, Judith, thank you so much. If you want the book, read more about the history of Seattle's wild salmon to craft beer. It's called The Food and Drink of Seattle. Judith H. Dern is the author. And I think it's a fun read. You know, I know I'm, for me personally, it's just like reading a little bit of my own history here in this town. So it's fantastic and loved it. Thank you. You
are both in the book.
Well, I'll have to come back and talk about some other things because I think the immigration thing, not only is it timely, but it's interesting in how we get to where we are today.
The best of the Seattle Kitchen here on Cairo Radio. My name is Sean. Thanks for tuning in. Next segment for you, chocolate chips. Tom has this thing where he doesn't really like too many chocolate chips in his cookie, but some people love a lot of chocolate chips. So we're going to learn where Tom actually falls on this issue, this hot issue, hot button issue here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
C is for cookie. That's good enough for me.
Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio. My name is Sean. This is the best of the Seattle Kitchen, actually, I should say. And this segment, we're going to learn about chocolate chips and cookies and whether or not they should be abundant or not abundant on Cairo Radio.
That's good enough for me.
You had a very strong opinion, Tom, about the ratio of chocolate chips within a cookie, and I believe you said no more than 20%.
I think I said somewhere around 20%.
Yeah.
Here's where I was going with that. There is a... I have to be careful here because I don't want to call anybody out, but it seems to be popular to, if some chocolate chips are good, that more chocolate chips must be better. And that's kind of what I was addressing. Because you remember on Emerald Show all
the
time?
I'm with you 100%.
Like, what happened? You taste everything, bam, I have to knock it up. I have to put another cup of garlic in there. Or I have to put more Emerald seasoning in there, right? It was just because some was good. Like a tablespoon of garlic was good. 3 tablespoons of garlic must be better. That's what I was fighting against. So then I'll extrapolate to where I was.
Really? He's really being defensive right now.
No, I totally am not. I'm trying to explain my basis. Because I was at a grocery store, a popular grocery store chain, and they have this huge chocolate chip cookie.
Yeah, I know the one.
And by the time I ate half of it, I was not feeling well. It wasn't that it wasn't delicious.
It was not because of the size of it?
Well, it was huge, and it was, I would say, at least 50 to 70% chocolate chips. So that's where
Robin is nodding her head. She is agreeing with you on this particular
Topic. Robin, thank you. Thank you for coming to the show.
I can't wait to hear your story.
No, thank you for having me. This is very fun. Very, very fun.
So, Robin, you heard this, and what...
Wait. Who are you? She does.
I think I mentioned it. Robin owns Hello Robin on 19th, and it's a beautiful little cookie shop, and that's what she does. She makes the most incredible cookies, and I am lucky enough to live just a couple blocks away and also be friends with Robin. So as you can imagine, there are endless amounts of cookies in my life. But Robin... You heard the segment and you thought, what to yourself?
I just thought, what is he talking about? 20% chocolate chips? That's not nearly enough. And I hate when you get a chocolate chip cookie and you can't see the chocolate.
Yeah.
And that you like flip it over and then you're like, oh, there's 3 in there. Or there's 5 in there. I want a bigger ratio.
Yeah. And, you know, I think Robin knows what's up because Hello Robin is a much beloved, very successful cookie shop. So in your, you know, if you were going to estimate, since Tom is now estimating and not sticking to his solid 20%, right, what would you estimate is the correct ratio?
So I think that a really good chocolate chip cookie needs at least 30%. But no more than 40.
Wow.
Okay, so you do have
accurate.
A ceiling.
Yeah.
Because I agree with that. I agree with Tom when he says, you know, the 50%. I mean, it's not a chocolate cookie anymore. It's chocolate with some cookie dough in it.
I agree. I agree. Like,
that becomes ridiculous. But I'm with you. I think 30 is probably a better ratio.
Right. I agree. And
you don't want to be lacking chocolate in a chocolate chip cookie.
Right.
You want to make sure you have chocolate.
It's not called a cookie with chocolate chips.
Correct.
It's called a chocolate chip cookie.
Correct.
And it's called that for a reason.
Okay. Did you hear her?
Okay,
everybody?
So then let's go down the path of what kind of chocolate.
Oh.
So what do you can we all just agree that I was wrong and that it's minimum 30?
Really? We're there already?
I'm not a baker.
Everybody.
So let's go back to the cookie itself, because I do like plenty of cookie with my chocolate chips. So you're saying minimum 30, high of 40.
Yeah.
What is yours?
I think that ours is probably 30. I'm going to say 34.
Uh-huh. And do you do that by weight?
Yeah, we do all of ours by weight. Mm. And I added up ours, and we did the math. Just to see how much it was, and I that's roughly what I estimate. But I brought cookies, and I also brought your cookbook because I was assuming, there's going to be like a cup of chocolate chips in this recipe, and then I looked at it, and there's a whopping 3 cups in your recipe in your cookbook.
Of chocolate chips, a very good cookbook.
Yes, yes.
And she's got all her pages marked.
No wonder why I don't make any money.
Yeah, there's 3 cups of chocolate chips, and it's milk chocolate chunks and bittersweet chunks. So he goes expensive and fancy, which I think is very smart.
Well,
and
I was
making this, and I thought, this is not going to be a good recipe. I can't wait to bring this down here, and I'm going to... But it's so good.
It was really good.
So what percentage is it?
Yeah, it's really good. Well, yours is way more than 20%. Because if the Toll House recipe is, I think it's like... 2 cups of chocolate chips.
But two what? It has to be like how many cookies is that?
Well, your recipe, I'd say yours is in the 30 to 40%.
So right in where yours.
Yeah,
is. Okay.
Yours is over.
By almost twice as much.
I want to show
you,
it.
Robin, are you saying he's almost twice as much as he was saying?
Uh-huh. But I love this. Robin went through. She was emailing myself and Amy Richardson last night. She was like, there are 3 cups in there. And then she was like, they are delicious.
Well, it's irrelevant unless you look at the size of the recipe.
That's right. So you can see, it has a lot of chocolate chips in it. And this is the test. You flip it over, and you can see how many chocolate chips. And this is a good ratio. I think this is a really good recipe.
So did you taste the cookie itself? Did you test it?
Oh, yeah, I tasted it. My kids tasted it. We all tasted it. Here, you should taste it.
So now, if I were to look at this, Chef, just looking at it visually, I wouldn't guess, because I'm not a baker, I don't know, but I wouldn't guess that there was more than 20% chocolate chips in there.
No.
If you were to look at that visually the bottom, right?
That's right.
So there, that's my only excuse, is that...
The problem is you wrote the recipe.
You have to eat this. He just threw a cookie at me. Okay, everybody.
I told you we're going to get down.
Get HR.
Okay, so now you're...
So wait, one quick thing. You see about 5 different chips on the bottom.
Yeah.
But let's not forget the cookie is thick.
Of course.
I just bite in there. There's a bunch of them hiding in the middle.
I think you should take a little bite of yours and a little bite of Robin's and give it the real test.
Well, this is nice and gooey.
Yeah, right.
So tell me about your cookie. You've read both recipes, which I haven't.
I love
this cookie. So tell me what's the difference between, say, the Hello Robin cookie and the Dahlia Bakery cookie.
So, I mean, the recipe is pretty different. You cream, in your recipe, you cream the eggs and the butter, and the technique is just really different. In ours, we start with cold butter, and we freeze the dough, which results in a thicker cookie, which is my thing. Like, I really, really love the thick
cookie. There's also more butter than yours. I can just look at it and taste it.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. You're not shy. I mean, you're not cheap. You're just making the... Right. Really good.
I like butter. I like sugar. I like chocolate.
Are you calling me cheap now?
Yeah.
Three cups of chocolate chips.
Yeah, right. Two types also. So that's our standard chocolate chip cookie, where it's just like a little bit thicker. It has a lot of chocolate. And you break it open, and it's not on trend with these really raw. That's another thing that right now is like and these raw cookies, which I don't like.
I'm 100% against that, too.
It makes me cringe.
Yeah. And this cookie that you made is very nice because it finishes very buttery in the mouthfeel.
Oh, good.
I mean, it's a very nice cookie.
It's crisp on the edges. It's delicate in the center. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really delicious chocolate chip.
And I think it's interesting how you made our recipe like 4 days ago and you made yours, yours this morning. Yours this morning, and so...
No,
yours are literally still warm. Tom,
that was a week ago.
Darn it, I didn't think you were going to call me out on that. okay, but I also brought down, because I know that this chocolate chip cookie is not for everyone, so we also make a really good whole wheat chocolate chip cookie, which sounds healthy, but it's so good. And this one has less chocolate, but it has these big discs, and it's finished with sea salt. It is so good.
Now, what's a technique-wise? Somebody at home can't just sub whole wheat flour for AP flour, right?
No.
So, what do you do to make it work?
There's baking powder and baking soda in this recipe. There's less whole wheat flour than there is all-purpose in the other recipe. There's no all-purpose in the, or there's no, I have chocolate all over me. There's no all-purpose in the whole wheat flour. It's just straight whole wheat.
It's delicious. I love the salt on the chocolate.
Because it's
something
French salt.
Most people don't recognize very well. It's
yes, it's French
chocolate.
Salt, like him. That's why he likes it so much.
He identifies with it.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, almost always when people try to sub whole wheat, they don't get. They're not successful. It's just but troublesome. But yours, that is delicious.
Yeah.
And I actually like it better because it tastes a little bit more earthy and mealy.
Yeah.
And I like that.
I like it too.
Yeah.
But, again, chocolate's not for everyone. So I also brought...
I thought I was done tasting.
The no chocolate. The snickerdoodle. And I think that's what I sent to you, and I called you a curmudgeon. And that's why you invited me on the radio.
Uh-huh.
Remember that?
Terry is loving this. He's like,
we have to wrap this up. So this is the cookie. This is the chocolate chip cookie without the chocolate chip.
That's right. That's a brown butter.
And you think this represents my attitude?
I do.
Okay.
It's so
fine.
Hey, Tom.
So be it.
If you were such a nice lady, I'd arm wrestle you right now.
Tom, it's crusty on the outside and soft on the inside.
Crusty.
Yes.
He said crusty.
True.
So, Robin, I concede defeat on my chocolate percentages. Your cookies are delicious, and
so is yours, Tom.
And I wouldn't hesitate to say I like it without chocolate too. So maybe that's what I was getting at: is that I don't mind a good Toll House cookie, but with or without the chips.
All right. It's cookie day, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that segment. And my name is Sean. This is the Best of the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio. Coming up, Rachel Bell is going to take us all truffle hunting somewhere locally. All right. This is Sean on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM.
Stop making that big face.
Thanks for tuning in here to the Best of the Seattle Kitchen. My name is Sean. I do appreciate your listenership. Coming up in this segment, Rachel Bell. Y'all know Rachel Bell, and if you don't, I don't know what you've been doing with your life. You're failing at it. She's going to take us somewhere locally where we can truffle hunt, and you can also teach or train your dogs to hunt for truffles as well. That's coming up right here on the Best of the Seattle Kitchen.
This was so cool because I did not know that there were truffles in them hills here in Western Washington. And when I went out with Truffle Dog Company, this business that will teach you to train your dog to be a truffle dog, they were like, oh yeah, they're everywhere. And so I was posting all these pictures on social media of the truffles we found, and everybody was messaging me going, are you in Italy right now? Where are you? And I was like, no, I'm an hour north of Seattle. Mm-hmm. So we have black truffles and we have white truffles. And we went out for an hour and filled a huge Ziploc bag with black truffles. Mm-hmm. I could not believe it. But the thing that they do is training dogs. So that is the best way to find truffles, the easiest way, and also the most environmental. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't use a dog, it's called raking. And so people will go out. First of all, truffles have a relationship with the Douglas fir tree. So that's where you're going to find them in the Douglas fir forest. So people will go out and just rake around those trees. And then that destroys the ecosystem. But also, they're just pulling up any truffles and they don't know if they're ripe or not. So the dogs are trained to only find the ripe truffles. So Pacific Northwest truffles had a bad reputation because these rakers were selling unripe truffles to restaurants and the chefs couldn't tell when they got them. And then they start trying to cook with them and they're like, these are not good.
They have no flavor.
And so now this one woman who owns this company, she's kind of the one who started this here in the Pacific Northwest, is making sure that local chefs are getting good truffles.
Oh, Rachel, do you know that it is my dream to have a Lagotto Romagnolo, the little cute truffle dogs?
Yes, that's the Italian dog, and she has two of them. They are very cute. So one of the coolest things that I learned was what to do with the truffles when you get home. I had only been familiar with shaving them on top of something like risotto or eggs or pasta, but she taught me about infusing. So what you do is you take a container and you put a handful of truffles in next to not touching something fatty. So they like to stick to fat. So you'd put in a whole stick of butter or a whole thing of cheese, or, which is really cool, raw eggs in their shells. And within around 24 hours in the fridge, the truffles will completely permeate those fats. They will stick to the yolk in the egg. So anything you make with those
will be truffly. So the truffles only last about a week and they go bad. But then you have, I have this, you know, butter in my fridge now for like 3 weeks that just continues to be truffled.
Now, if it smelled really good, you wouldn't be able to open your fridge without being blown away. I mean, that's what a beautiful white truffle will do, right?
Yeah.
The aroma is so intense.
Yes. So you have to have it in a sealed container. Yeah. Otherwise, your whole fridge will get truffly.
Actually, you should be careful about sealing it because it's a live product. So you actually don't want to seal it.
Or if you do, you have to put it with rice or something.
Yeah, like put it with rice so humidity doesn't rot the truffle.
She told me to put a bed of paper towel and then change that out every day so that because it did start to get moist. But so I made a truffle mac and cheese with the butter that I truffled, the sharp cheddar that I truffled, and then I shaved truffles on top.
Uh-huh.
It was so delicious. I truffled an avocado and made avocado toast with it. I actually truffled a butternut squash that I had roasted, and I just put that in the container, and it stuck to the oil. I truffled my stapler. I truffled my cat. Like, it's so good. And it's so fun to go foraging because, you know, where we live up here, there's so many amazing things, crab and mushrooms and truffles, and it's all the most expensive things, and you're getting them for free, and it's really fun. It's like thrift store shopping in the forest.
So where did you go hunting?
I don't know that you can just ask that. She almost gave it up, too, until I warned her.
No, I'll tell you the city, but I won't tell you exactly where. But we were just in Stanwood, and honestly, we were right off of a dirt road. We walked in about 3 steps, and a dog found a truffle. It's not like we were deep, deep in the forest. And she says that you can train any dog that they've had through their program, Chihuahuas all the way up to Burmese Mountain Dogs. So if you're listening
I'm being more comfortable with a Burmese.
I mean, some dogs are better than others, but all dogs have good noses, and she claims that any dog can be a truffle dog.
So let's talk about the dog for a second, since Katie is so enamored. No. What did you call that at the Italian one?
Allegato Romagnolo.
I'm so impressed that you know that.
I love this dog. I think that they are just like a really, really smart, clever. And I think like the AKC describes him as like undemanding.
Would that be the American Kennel Club?
Yes. That's the one.
Sorry.
You're on the acronym level.
You got it.
Well, you know, I met a breeding pair of those dogs at the Blackberry Farm in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee because they have a whole program there, and their dogs, they get, you know, 3 litters a year, I think, is what the thing is, and they are 4 years out, those dogs.
Oh, you're
on a
long
waiting. And they are
$12,000
a puppy.
Whoa.
$12,000 a puppy for that classic, what did you call it?
A Allegato Romagnolo.
Yeah, of course, that one.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They look like a doodle. They're curly and very cute and fuzzy.
Yeah, and they're not super big, and they don't have fur. They have hair, so they're hypoallergenic, and they're good with other animals.
And they can find them truffles.
And they can find them savory, savory fungi.
I'm going to ask Chef a question about this, since you are so enamored with all the aromas of these truffles. Chef, I know I have never had an aromatic Northwest truffle. Have I just not had a ripe truffle, or do you agree with me that they just don't have the punch?
No, I agree with you. What the problem is, you and I are both used to the Perigo and the Italian truffles, and they definitely beat the punch on that one. They're definitely a lot more tasty. They keep their flavor, and they keep their odor a lot longer.
Uh-huh.
My biggest problem that I have found with the black truffle from the Northwest is when you put it in warm, it dissipates, and you don't have a, you know, so...
When you put it in warm what?
In warm liquid or warm sauce or whatever, it dissipates totally, and you don't have any backup with that. So I definitely agree with Rachel about you definitely should put it in cold product, butter, whatever you're going to do, and, you know, infuse it into that in a cold manner. I do oil with that. Like if you take half olive oil and half canola oil or another oil, and you blend the whole thing into a blender with a big truffle, you'll have a wonderful truffle oil, and it will be real truffle oil as opposed to what's on the market, which is all synthetic. So
yeah, I don't think most people know if you buy a bottle of truffle oil, it is usually synthetic.
Yeah, there's just out of a lab somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not talking about a dog.
I thought that the black truffles were a little bit mild, and just like you said, they dissipated. Yeah, but the white truffles were very, very aromatic, the ones that they found. They were very, very strong. And yeah, they were really good for infusion, but the white ones were also quite pungent when I shaved them over food as well.
I think it's the white one is always a little bit stronger. It's what the
white differentiate from the black. Mm-hmm. It's usually more perfume.
How many white compared to black did you find? You had a whole Ziploc.
Where we were was only black truffle. So there's okay. certain areas that have white and have black, but they had white in the truck. And so they just gave me a bunch of the white ones.
That
and,
is nice.
And you know people who do this, they don't mean anything to them anymore. Because I was like, no, this is too many. I'm not going to be able to use them in time before they go. But they're like, just take them. Who cares? Uh-huh. They're like, I can't even give them away anymore to our family and friends. They don't want them. And I was like, okay. And I have this like Santa sack. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's
very
all
cool.
of Western Washington, also in Oregon. The variety is actually called an Oregon truffle, even though they're in Washington. So yeah, the company is called Truffle Dog Company.
The best of the Seattle kitchen has concluded. You're welcome. Unless you've really enjoyed the time here, then I'm super sorry, but we've got to go. There's another show or infomercial or commercial that's needing to play right now. So my name is Sean. This has been the best of the Seattle kitchen. So tune in next week when Tom and Terry will be back, and you'll learn some new things that you probably didn't know. Thanks for tuning in on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.